You were listening to a Pleasure Podcast. For more from our sex podcast collective, visit pleasurepodcasts.com.
I'm Tristan Taramino, and this is Sex Out Loud.
That's why I'm literally writing a whole book about my gender.
My mom and I were on BBC together talking about sex work and disability, which is something I never thought I would ever do.
Where do we learn about how to react to bodily fluid?
People have abortions more than we want to admit, and abortion is beyond healthcare. It's really body autonomy.
Someone talks about porn ruining sex. The question for me is, which porn?
I don't want anybody to fetishize my Jewishness who wouldn't stand next to me at a march.
I just wanted to show polyamory in a way that looks like polyamory.
If you're excited by sexual pleasure and sexual politics, you've come to the right place.
I've been this radical queer agnostic theologian for a long time.
They think that Muslims don't have sex.
There is a very specific history of racism and anti-blackness in this country.
I don't know who started this myth that after people are sexually assaulted, they never want to fornicate again.
We really don't think that change happens without knowing what we're for and not just what we're against.
Welcome to Sex Out Loud, everyone. I think queer history, and especially multiple queer histories, are really important. And some of them simply don't get recorded. They don't get documented. They don't get archived. And they have the potential to sort of slip away once all the people who are involved are gone. So I'm really excited about my guest and the work that she has done to capture a particular part of queer history. Let me tell you about her. Prize-winning journalist and author Kelly Cogswell set out from Kentucky armed with only an electric typewriter, a stack of poems, and willingness to scrape by as a maid, a dishwasher, a prep cook, and a temporary secretary. In New York, following an unscheduled and naked performance that stunned the NYU Department of Performance Studies, she decided to put her Medusa-like powers to good use, first as a lesbian activist, and later as an independent journalist and monger of extremely underground art. She was awarded the Joan Heller Diane Bernard Fellowship for her project documenting the Lesbian Avengers, and her book, Eating Fire, My Life as a Lesbian Avenger, was a finalist for a Lambda Literary Award, a Publishing Triangle Award, and was also featured on the 2015 Over the Rainbow Project book list. Her most recent project is a new memoir, A Word of Our Own, which explores the word lesbian in stories about her body and life. She's currently locked down in Paris, which I think isn't a bad place to be locked down in. Welcome to Sex Out Loud, Kelly.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So let's start with Eating Fire, My Life as a Lesbian Avenger. You've done all this extensive documentation of the Lesbian Avengers, which was such an important moment. For me, the Lesbian Avengers were founded like very soon after I graduated college and moved to New York City. So I was very much a baby dyke, and I was like, oh, Lesbian Avengers. So let's talk about how it was founded and sort of what the goals and the mission was.
Well, the Lesbian Avengers were founded by six dykes in New York City who, a lot of them had been involved in other activist projects and other artistic projects. But what they all felt was it was a moment when lesbians needed their own project. So the focus obviously was on lesbians and specifically issues related to lesbian survival and visibility.
And what's interesting about this New York City that you paint a picture of is it was pre-Giuliani in the beginning, pre-gentrification of the East Village, and obviously many more neighborhoods to come, which would be gentrified. And so there was still the notion that you could, as a dyke and an artist, have housing and survive on low wages, which now in New York City is impossible.
Yeah, it was like in the East Village, the process of gentrification had already started, but it wasn't so far along that you couldn't find a loft and share it with, you know, five other people and somehow survive. But the days were already gone when you could, you know, find an apartment to yourself that was rent controlled. But it still was a moment when the East Village was very vibrant, when there were lots of art galleries and art in the street and underground clubs. And still a lot of dykes there before the dykes got priced out.
And one of the things that Lesbian Avengers did was they founded the International Dyke March. For baby queers out there who don't know the history, can you tell me about the first International Dyke March?
The first dyke march happened in the spring of 1993. You should know probably that when the Lesbian Avengers started, it was 1992. And it kind of reminds me a little bit about now, when there was a huge backlash against everything progressive and there was another fight for the soul of America. But there was then, as now, always a struggle for lesbians to be visible in the LGBT community. So what happened, there was a big march scheduled for Washington, D.C. in the spring of 1993, and the Lesbian Avengers looked at all the activities that were scheduled and noticed that there was really very little for lesbians. So what they thought is, what do we need? We need a march. We need a dyke march. And then we worked with some other lesbian groups to make that happen. But we really pushed it really, really hard. We reached out to every lesbian project, it felt like, in the universe. And miraculously, we set the starting place for DuPont Circle in DC. And bit by bit, we looked around, and instead of there being a couple of hundred people, there were thousands and thousands of dykes. And we marched to the White House and ate fire in front of the White House, and it was pretty amazing.
And then do you think the Dyke March that happens every year in New York City, I mean, it is a continuation of that project, yes?
Yeah, absolutely. Most of the Dyke Marches that you see across the U.S. and in some other countries, too, are sort of children of that first Dyke March. Because the Lesbian Avengers went to that march in D.C., actively recruiting lesbians to participate in direct action. Because that was, it was lesbian visibility, but through direct action, that's what the Lesbian Avengers were doing. And dykes went home and they were starting Lesbian Avenger chapters. And part of that was creating their own dyke marches in the cities where they were, and sort of with their own styles.
Okay, so let's talk about direct action, because the thing about Lesbian Avengers is there were some very legendary actions. I'm thinking about the one at the UN. I'm thinking about the one at the Spanish language radio station. And it seemed to me this was a space where sort of some of the inspiration of ACT UP and Queer Nation you can see in this direct action, this sort of radical, like, street level stuff. But it was all run by women. And so in some ways it was different. Do you think that?
Well, you first of all, you should take your history back a little further. A lot of the people pushing direct action in ACT UP and Queer Nation were dykes who had already been doing direct action since the 70s, including taking over, you know, media stations and doing it to protest, for instance, women being forcibly sterilized, because that was already happening to some immigrant women and women in Puerto Rico, our American colony. So it was actually direct action is not foreign to dykes. We have been doing it forever. But one of the important things about direct action for lesbians is that women in general are less often seen in public spaces than males are, and much more likely to be there taking up space. And so it's kind of doubly transgressive for lesbians to take to the street and not only declare that there are things that they need in their daily lives and politically, but also just to be there is transgressive.
So Lesbian Avengers had a bunch of internal issues, which you talk about in the book. The group grappled with race, class, culture, and then also sort of philosophy, language, goals. Let's just talk about that for a minute. It wasn't unique to Lesbian Avengers, right, that these issues would come up, especially in sort of in feminist groups. But what do you feel like ultimately kind of fractured the group?
Well, almost every activist group comes to an end. I mean, you do, if you're lucky, you have a life at all, because a lot of groups, you have two meetings, everybody fights, and then that's the end of it. Well, I mean, let's be honest. Activists have, you're an activist because you have strong opinions. And when you get a lot of people with strong opinions in a room, what do? They fight. And the Avengers were amazing. They were miraculous in that they lasted for maybe 4 years and did do amazing actions like take over a radio station and broadcast for a little while. And disrupt, a black tie dinner at the UN. But whenever you have groups that are not homogenous, and the Lesbian Avengers were racially mixed, they were mixed in terms of class. People came from, the differences weren't just those differences, but people's backgrounds, like you had students and taxi drivers and writers and artists, and also came from a wide geography across the US, and we all know that our regions are not homogenous either. So it takes a bit of work to stay together. And also at the time in the early 90s, there was this big backlash against all progressive things and active efforts made to drive wedges between white gay people and people of color. Like the conservatives were always saying, oh, you know, those gay people want special rights, mm-hmm. while you real minorities, you black and brown people, you deserve things. So there was always, so besides the everyday sort of racism that we had, there was extra pressure, especially on the dykes of color in the group. You know, you're betraying your community working with those white people. So that was a huge thing. But also we had been working nonstop for many years and everybody was exhausted. And that didn't help things either. And also we did begin to have differences over thinking what was the future of the group, because we actually had gone pretty far in what we wanted, which was to create visibility for lesbians. When we first started, people could barely even spell the word lesbian. There was literally an instance where somebody could not spell the word lesbian.
Oh my God.
But then it became, okay, so we have a certain amount of visibility. We've created this. So what happens when you have visibility for your issues? That is going to be also the question for American activists around Black Lives Matter. What happens now that there's this, I focused on police brutality, what happens now that people are starting to see race? How do you create long-term lasting social change? And that is something that is more complicated. And the Lesbian Avengers were already shifting a little bit to doing some grassroots organizing and political work, which is different than direct action, which is very immediate and very focused on visibility. It's like, what do you do next?
Mm-hmm. Well, you bring up Black Lives Matter, which is a great segue to my next question, which is that reading this about the early 90s, I've got to say there's a lot here that resonates with queer and social justice activism today. So I'm wondering if you think, especially around the conflicts, if social justice activists keep repeating the same stuff decade after decade.
A little bit. But I think one of the things I tried to go into in the book, Eating Fire, was that the first half was sort of the rise and fall of the Lesbian Avengers. And the second half was me sort of trying to you know, it's still a memoir, but I'm trying to think about, well, how does social change work and how does identity politics work? Mm-hmm. And kind of digesting that through what I was doing at the time, which was journalism and being a sort of citizen journalist, which we called in the old days. I don't know. I don't know what sort of independent journalists, how they would identify today. But so I began to think about how this worked. And what I ended up writing a lot about was just the bare bones of democracy. Like, what does it take for us to be able to do social change? Well, you need freedom of speech. You need the right to assemble. You need a media which is, you know, honest and effective. And I feel like in some ways, you know, when I was first writing about democracy, it was considered a dirty word that only conservatives would talk about democracy, and it was kind of fake. And now people are a little bit more concerned about democracy. But I think for us to see a way forward, we have to kind of get back to the bare bones of what we even need to be able to have any movements whatsoever. Because queers are screwed if we don't pay attention to those things that allow us to work for our rights.
Yeah, and I think now more than ever that's a real issue. Like, you know what I mean? Like you said, one of the things you said was like, we can trust the media, which, you know, has been eroded to such an extent that we can't actually trust the media, even what we think of as the progressive media, which absolutely spent 4 years normalizing Trump in a way that was disturbing. Like, yeah. Just, you know, not calling lies lies. And not fact-checking things and quoting his, like, dumb tweets.
Yeah, and this is not a new problem. It's just getting worse and worse and worse. And also got worse as all the media sort of consolidated. Because already after September 11th, when Bush created Homeland Security, there was already an unwillingness of, like, the New York Times to say the word torture when the American government was torturing prisoners. And already there was a problem with, for instance, the counting of votes, because Al Gore, as it turned out, would have won Florida by, like, I don't know, like 38 votes or something if they had all been counted, if the Supreme Court hadn't said, no, we're stopping it now, and Bush wins. So I think that all the problems we have now are not new, and they didn't suddenly miraculously emerge. So I think people don't understand that democracy and the, you know, like, we never had a perfect country, no problem. But what we had were promises of a better country and the tools to work to make this better country. And I think by kind of ignoring the basic structure, the basic tools that we had, we are now in a situation where we find ourselves needing media more than ever. We find ourselves needing free speech more than ever. And we have just sort of backed ourselves into a corner with that.
Okay, we're going to take a commercial break so that we can pay for the show. When we come back, more with Kelly Cogswell. Stay with us. Need to unwind after a long day of Zoom calls? Looking for some new self-care ideas? Or maybe you're just looking for a way to get out of a funk and start feeling like yourself again? Reset and reconnect with yourself with Dipsy. Dipsy is an audio app full of short, sexy stories designed to turn you on. They release new stories every week, so there's always something more to explore, no matter who you're into or what you're into. Hookups, fantasies, long-term couples, they've got it, and they bring it right to your ear holes. Dipsy also has wellness sessions to help you learn more about yourself and bedtime stories and soundscapes to help you relax before you drift off. And sleep has finally come to Dipsy. I think this is really great news. They've got a couple features in this department. Sleepovers features popular Dipsy characters speaking directly to listeners to say goodnight and tuck them in. They're meant to feel cozy and comforting while you drift off. Soundscapes feature calming sounds to fall asleep to that are focused on just sounds, no storytelling, no characters, just things like ocean waves and rain. I have personally been using soundscapes to help me sleep forever, probably for more than a decade. Playing these different soothing sounds really, really resets my brain and says, okay, it's time to shut off. It's time to stop thinking and overthinking and just relax. So these soundscapes are a no-brainer for me. I love them. For listeners of the show, Dipsy is offering a 30-day free trial when you go to dipsystories.com/Tristan. That's a 30-day free trial when you go to dipseastories.com/Tristan. dipsystories.com/Tristan. You'll thank me. Welcome back to Sex Out Loud. I'm talking with prize-winning journalist and author Kelly Cogswell. She's in Paris, France, which is very fancy, and quite frankly, I wish I was there. So we talked before the break about how things have sort of stayed the same, how things have changed. And I feel like you're in this really unique position to look at a big picture over decades and decades. So I understand like what hasn't changed. What do you think has changed?
Yikes.
Oh, great. That's really, really inspires confidence.
In some ways, in the LGBT community and the queer community, I feel like one of the shifts has been further and further towards thinking about gender and not thinking anymore about sexual orientation. And I think that we've also gotten further from sort of more radical roots. And pulled a lot of theory from like academia rather than people being involved who came to the LGBT community. From example, I mean, some of the early activists were involved in workers' rights, and some of them, you know, Harry Hayes, who was a communist. A lot of the dykes had been involved in workers' rights and immigrant women's rights. And I feel like everybody quit talking about feminism a long time ago, you know, left, right, and center. And we've kind of rewritten that history in a way that is like, oh, it only benefits white women. Well, whenever you start talking about white feminism, you're essentially erasing all the women of color that have been feminists and have been working in feminism since it started. Even the suffragettes in the U.S. had many African-American women among them that we've all meant that we erase every time we use the phrase white feminism. So as you can tell, I'm not a big fan of that. But what comes to me is that one of the things that I think that has changed, why this is important, is that we focused on gay marriage for a long time, which actually benefits there were a lot of dykes of color involved in that because it was like a huge gain for them. But then on the other hand, you had lots and lots of middle and upper class white gay men that for them it was, they could be just like their neighbors. That's what it was good for. It wasn't really so much economic protection as, yay, we're just the same as everybody else. So right now, when the whole world practically is moving towards authoritarianism, and is what it feels like some days. And also the attacks on abortion are not just in the US, but you see, you know, in you're seeing it now in Poland. But for the last several weeks, we've had like huge demos in Poland because the Supreme Court there just issued a ruling that restricted it even further to where it's almost impossible to get an abortion in Poland. And all of these things, when female bodies are under attack, it has an impact on LGBT people. And when you're attacking and trying to control female bodies, you know, that obviously has an impact on lesbians because we're bad women, because we're not there for men to impregnate. We're not there to raise their children. We're not there to listen to them. We're not there to make their breakfast. But it also has an impact on gay men because gay men are supposed to be keeping us under their thumbs, right? They're supposed to be propagating this whole structure. And trans people, of course, are not doing the things with their bodies that they were supposed to be doing either. So if you don't start paying attention right now to what is happening to abortion and control of women and their bodies, then this is going to trickle up or trickle down or trickle over and have a huge impact on the LGBT community. Maybe not today, but it's there and we should be aware.
Okay, so that brings me to, you have this new newsletter on Substack, A Dyke Abroad. really good pun. And you say it offers lesbian views on everything, especially politics, Paris, feminist issues, and the thing in the back of my fridge. So in one of these posts, you actually have a different take on the confirmation of ultra-conservative Amy Coney Barrett to the U.S. Supreme Court. And since she may be critical to further restricting abortion rights or even striking down Roe v. Wade, like, what is your take on what possible damage she can do and how that applies to queer people?
Well, first, I think people should be aware that a lot of abortion rights are dependent on what's going on inside the state itself. Each state, because the federal government of the U.S. is not in control of everything. The states themselves have a lot of powers. So a lot of states have restricted abortion so much, and also abortion clinics like set up rules that are almost impossible to comply with. So that there are now very, very, very few places that women can get abortions at all now already. And even under Obama, it was already terrible. So that even if you strike down Roe v. Wade, it's not like it was some miracle thing giving all women the right to abortions, because right now there were so many practical impediments to getting one that it might have as well been struck down 10 years ago. So I think it's not quite honest to focus only on Roe v. Wade when what's happening in, like, I grew up in Kentucky, and there's only one clinic in the entire state that does late-term abortions. And that means if you need one, you have to drive miles and miles and hours to get a, and most women don't have much, you know, a lot of time. You can't get off work, so you end up having to have the baby. So anyway, that's, you know, that was something that I was writing about, like thinking about, are we, when we talk about, oh my God, we have to be careful about the Supreme Court because of Roe v. Wade, and then we're not paying attention to what's going on around us. I think a lot of the politics we need to be paying attention to are local politics and community politics, because that's where, for one thing, that's where we can control, that's where we can have an impact and not feel horribly helpless. And also it's, you know, anyway.
No, I totally know what you mean. On election day, the morning after election day, I saw on my Twitter feed, Dahlia Ferlito, who is the founder of White People for Black Lives, had what I can only describe as a pep talk, because it was a pep talk for me, where they basically laid out many of the victories that happened in Los Angeles around racial equity, around incarceration, and around reallocating funding for things like community mental health instead of prisons and jails, and also ousting our district attorney, who has failed to basically prosecute any officer who's ever killed anyone. And this has been going on for a long time. And so I appreciated that they just sort of reframed, like, this national thing is going on, but also look at what's happening in your communities and look at how this, like, ongoing activism and just relentless activism in Los Angeles with Black Lives Matter, with Movement for Black Lives, with Justice Now, has really led to some, like, real change.
Yeah, it does. There's always something to do, and probably it's right around the corner from you. I mean, it's interesting to me if you're thinking about what lesbians can do to be visible, but also to create change. As soon as Trump got elected in 2016 or shortly thereafter, a bunch of old activists in New York started different activist projects, one of them being Rise and Resist. And because, as always, lesbians kind of get sidelined, they started joking and saying, oh, yeah, we're the revolting lesbians. And then they're like, oh, yeah, revolting lesbians. So they started their own group, and they were still focused on Trump, but they had this name that kept them visible as lesbians at the same time they worked for Trump. And I think one of the things that we can do is think of sort of how we can multitask, thinking of how do you have a national impact on the local level? How do you turn this thing I can do near me into something, you know, how do things have bigger impacts? Is it by just being visible as a lesbian, but at the same time I'm working on environmental issues? But I think that the people that we're up against essentially want us to feel disempowered, want us to feel like we can't do anything. And it's just never not true. It's never true that we can't do anything.
Well, but that's also part of the totalitarianism, right? Is to sort of divide and, you know, and feel like wear people out, right? I mean, yeah. You said about being burnt out. You know, obviously there's burnout in social justice movements now also. It's like, it's really fucking exhausting to get up every day and be like, oh my God, end this.
Well, I think maybe we need to reframe that we don't have to be street activists every day all the time, that we need to think about how we can pace ourselves, because Trump did so much damage in 4 years alone that it will take generations to repair it. And already George W. Bush had done damage that was not entirely repaired under Obama. So I think that you kind of just have to pick something and then decide you're going to do a little something on it instead of dropping everything. You can't live that way. You have to, you know, you have to go to work. You have relationships, you have family, somebody's got to make dinner. You have to find a way to, you can't necessarily do everything yourself, but just find some little corner where you feel like you can do something and then do it. It's not your burden alone to change the world. Everybody has to contribute a little something.
And of course, there are queers in all of these movements, right? There are queers in workers' rights. There are queers in environmentalism. Like, there are queers in sex worker rights movements. So that's also important, that, like, we've been in all of these movements and continue to be in these movements. And so while we're there, we can also maintain visibility and bring up in situations, how does this affect queer sex workers over other kinds of sex workers, right? How does this affect trans sex workers? And also they're all kind, you know, all these things are related. I mean, I'm thinking of, in the 2000s, you did this online magazine called The Gully. And it seems like it was ahead of its time in the sense that it tackled global queer politics and sort of made connections between, okay, what's going on in Cuba? What's going on in Puerto Rico? What's going on in Africa? And so I feel like it was ahead of its time. Do you feel like it was ahead of its time?
I think so. And also, I mean, we went to it with an international perspective. The co-founder was my partner, Ana Maria Sima, who grew up in Cuba, and then she lived in France before she came to New York. So we were already thinking about international issues and questions of racism and class and all of that. But also, we're both very aware that you, lesbian, just speaking of sexual orientation, like lesbians and gay men face the same things pretty much everywhere, but you just find them in different proportions. Like, most of us are born into straight families. Most of us have to grapple with religions that are not welcoming to us. Most of us have to deal with, it holds true for trans people too. Most of us have to deal with getting harassed on the street. Most of us have to deal with police that are not thrilled with us. Most of us have to deal with often with sort of organized and systemic discrimination by the state. So it benefits all of us when we talk about what we have in common and not just what is different. So we tried to put people in touch horizontally, like talk about what somebody, for instance, was experiencing in Namibia, and was that the same as what somebody was experiencing in Guatemala? And sometimes it was the same and sometimes it was a little different. But what everybody said was that you just had to be able to at least talk about your experience, because that in itself was already progress. So then here we are back to the importance of freedom of speech, because also when you start talking about it, you discover that you do have support, that you do have other people in the world that are like you, which is sometimes just the most radical and amazing thing that you can learn, that you're not alone. The other thing that we discovered is that when you find homophobia, you often find misogyny, you often find racism, that there's like a bundle of problems that are especially expressed in conservative governments or authoritarian governments, whether the authoritarian governments are from the right or from the left, that they control all sorts of, you know, they don't want opposition from any quarter. So we worked a lot in seeing sort of where the threads were and where they kind of met in the middle, and how do you fight them? How do you unravel those threads and see if there's some corner where you can resist?
Okay, we're going to take our final commercial break. And when we come back, more with Kelly Cogswell. Hi, everyone. Take a deep breath. That's what it says when you open the Calm app for the first time. Let's do that. Let's stop and take a deep breath. When I use Calm, it makes me stop, be present in the moment, and let everything going on around me fall away for a little while. And I need that now more than ever. Plus, I know lots of us have had insomnia, and Calm sleep stories help me unwind and get a better night's sleep. Calm has been a game changer in my life, and I want you all to be able to try it. For listeners of the show, Calm is offering a special limited time promotion of 40% off a Calm premium subscription at calm.com/Tristan. For the price of about 4 grande mochas, you can get access to Calm's entire library. Hundreds of hours of meditations, soundscapes, sleep stories, breathing exercises, even stuff for kids. Get started today at calm.com/Tristan for 40% off a premium subscription. That's calm.com/Tristan. Welcome back to Sex Out Loud, everyone. I'm talking to Kelly Cogswell and getting a kind of masterclass in queer activism throughout the years. I want to pick up on something you said before the break, which is this notion that queers are often facing similar problems no matter where they are sort of located globally. But I do feel like Americans have it easier in some ways. I'm thinking of, I met this great activist in Colombia, and he was saying, you know, trans people, especially trans people who are Black, are just murdered in the street. And I thought, okay, yeah, we have that too. But then he said, but this, it's at the hands of the police. And there's not sort of outcry. There isn't, citizens don't come forward because they're afraid that then they'll out themselves as queer and trans. And so in some ways, there is privilege in the United States in that we seemingly have, some of us, especially for white and educated and middle class, have more rights than people around the world.
Oh, no, we definitely do. No, there's no question that people in the U.S. are extremely privileged. But it also depends on region. It depends on neighborhood. Mm-hmm. But no, we don't have cops going out hunting trans people, right, or hunting gay men.
Yes.
And they do in some places.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And some places cops hunt a lot of people that the government wishes didn't exist. Absolutely, U.S. queers are privileged. But if you look at the history of U.S. queers, at some point, at different points, earlier points before Stonewall, that came out of stories of police harassment, not being slaughtered in the street, but systematic oppression from the state. That was formal policy of our cities to go and get rid of queer activity. And for instance, it's more a matter of intersecting and levels of how extreme certain repressions are. I think I would be a better way for me to express it than the fact that we're not all on a level playing field.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely not. But we all do recognize that here, you know, governments have ways of getting involved in these things. The churches have ways of getting involved in these things. Families, you know, we recognize the elements of our oppression, even though in one place the cops may just sort of roust you from the street corner where you were talking with your friends. In another place, they might actually try to kill you. In one place, your family might just not be that nice to you. In another place, they'll lock you up in a mental hospital. Mm. So I think that we have, our experiences are not exactly the same, but they are familiar to, you know, all of us.
So there's this thread in your work and activism of lesbian visibility. And I'm so intrigued that you're writing a book which is framed around the word lesbian. And I'm wondering what you make of how we achieve lesbian visibility in this moment in time where there's a whole new generation of people who are like, I don't label myself anything. There's this dating app here, hashtag open, where you can choose from 24 different sexual orientations, including homoflexible and demisexual and asexual. And so I feel like this new generation is sort of disregarding labels altogether, disregarding identity politics, as it were. And so in a world where these words have less power and meaning, how does lesbian visibility fit into that?
Well, first of all, the word lesbian has never been popular. There's always been stigma attached to it. The word lesbian was used comfortably for 5 minutes with the Lesbian Avengers, I think, around then. And then it's used for political purposes as a political identity. And I think, you know, people can call themselves whatever they want and identify or not identify as a lesbian, except when it comes to politics. Because if you don't have a word to describe yourself as a group, you can't have a voice as a group. You can't identify your needs as a group. And you can't articulate your experience and your history. So the use of the word lesbian is a very, very political act. You're saying, I have something in common with the other girls who, you know, at 10 and 12 or 8, looked at other girls and were interested. You know, I have something in common with that girl who got called Lezzy before she even felt a stirring of desire for another woman. You're saying you have something in common with the people thrown out of their jobs. You have something in common with the history of women who lost their children when they came out. You're saying you have something in common with all of these same-sex attracted women. You're saying that this experience matters. And of course, you know, like when you're just sitting at home with your girlfriend or by yourself, you're not feeling lesbian-y. It doesn't matter. You don't have to use this language all the time, but you have to understand that it has a purpose, the same way that Black has a meaning, the same way that Latino has a meaning. That when you start saying, well, what do these people have in common? What do I have in common with this other person using this word? Often the response is nothing. You often have nothing in common with the other people using the word except for this one thing, this one experience, or maybe if you're Black, it's the experience of racism. But what does some urban person from, I don't know, Chicago have in common with a rural Black person from Alabama? Like hardly anything. Like you probably can't even understand each other when you're talking if you have like a major Alabama accent. So it's looking for the point of intersection. And for the word lesbian, for me, it's like the intersection of misogyny and homophobia by and large. And thinking about that and thinking about what it means to choose to inhabit that word and to see myself as having something in common with the other people that have used that word.
It's so funny that you say sitting alone, thinking of yourself as lesbian, because the other day, this is before the election, my friend Holly, shout out to Holly, texted me and said, like, here is a balm during BALM, during this really stressful time. And it was a link to Tracy Chapman doing a version of Revolution. And I think it was on one of the late night shows. Yeah. And I was like, oh my God, this is amazing. And, you know, Tracy Chapman doesn't perform a lot anymore. So you can't see these like live performances. And I was like, this is amazing. This is everything. This is going to calm me down. And she wrote back, we're so lesbian. And it was really the most perfect way to describe the situation for me. It wasn't like we're so queer or it was so lesbian, right? Like singer-songwriters and music and all that stuff. So sometimes I do, I guess, sit alone in my house.
And you're being lesbian-y.
And I'm being lesbian-y. Yeah, I am.
Yeah. I mean, I think also the word lesbian, because it's so gendered, because it's a word that's very sexed, it shuts the door on the male privilege by association that you get if you're just queer or you just, you know, or a word without a label. And I don't know. I mean, I have really mixed feelings about it because it's because identity is like is a weird thing that it operates mostly when other people are looking at you and you're taking on attributes of your group. And when you're by yourself, like, what are you really? But the thing is that it shouldn't always just be about the horrible experiences we're having. Like being Black shouldn't only be about, you know, having trouble with cops or other people of your category getting killed. It should also be the joy of that history and that culture, the same way that being a lesbian shouldn't just be, oh, gross, you know, the stigma of the of homosexuality, or nowadays it's like the idea that our history with feminism somehow has turned into something monstrous. That in fact, lesbian activists have done incredible things for women of all races. And we have been in part of every social change movement ever. You know, they're manning the ramparts. And I think that it would be nice if it was like, oh, sitting around listening to Tracy Chapman. Oh my God, I listened to the album of hers on repeat for like a gazillion. I can't even I knew every word of that album for a long time.
right.
But it should, you know, like when we should find ways not just to reclaim the words, but the histories associated with the words. And the joy and the accomplishments of these histories, because it's like, oh my God, we've survived and we managed to make art and music and have some great sex and sometimes, you know, show our extremely wicked sense of humor, that there should be room for to share the good stuff and not only get together when we have to, like, you know, put on the Doc Martens and go kick some ass.
Well, that's a great note to end on. Thank you so much, Kelly, for this conversation. I really appreciate it.
Well, thanks for asking me.
So the book we talked about is Eating Fire, My Life as a Lesbian Avenger. It's from the University of Minnesota Press. You can get it where you buy books. I especially encourage you to support local and independent bookstores. You can do that online through bookshop.org, which does not pay me for that endorsement. Okay, you can find Kelly on the web at kellycogswell.com, C-O-G-S-W-E-L-L. And kellycogswell.substack.com. There's some really good stuff on there. On Twitter, she's at Kelly at Large. And on Instagram, she's Kelly Sans Culotte. Is that the word?
Yeah.
I think that's French. There's some French joke in there, yeah?
Yeah. The Sans Culotte were a political movement, but it also means without underwear.
Without underwear. Very good. I want to shout out my engineer and editor, A-Rod, at FTC Designs, who you can follow on Twitter at FTC_designs. New episodes go up on podcast platforms on Mondays. I always appreciate your reviews. I've gotten yet another review on iTunes from a white cis het man who feels oppressed by my attitudes on the show and feels disenfranchised and no longer wants to listen to my show because of that. So if you want, you can go and talk about how I'm not actually a man-hater, or not. I'm on social media across all platforms at Tristan Terramino. The show's on Twitter at Sex Out Loud Radio. And until next time, take some time to talk about sex out loud.